Everybody on tape? Good. You taping right now? All right.
From Seattle, the Earth on the Air Radio Works presents Earth on the Air.
In the next half hour, Earth on the Air's independent contributors explore the growing global consciousness of ordinary citizens.
Individuals reaching out across continents to work for global understanding in the hopes that if the people lead, the leaders will follow.
We'll travel to the Middle East on a peace ship, the Ibn Khaldun.
Visit El Salvador with a citizen diplomat.
And hear how environmentalists are working globally without ever leaving home.
Also, stories, thoughts from the streets, music, and more.
Nation states and borderlines, divided states of mind. Politics comes to blows and everybody wants to know, whose world is this? Whose world is this? Whose world is this?
We have before us the opportunity to forge for ourselves and for future generations a new world order.
New world order. What does that term mean to you?
There's a lot of changes that have gone on in the world, but there's still no order.
New world order. I'd say it has about as much order as the eye of a tornado.
There was the coup in Thailand and the people getting together.
Right now, with all the nationalistic tendencies in Eastern Europe,
Yugoslavia is having problems.
The Serbians have already declared they'll step up their attack if recognition.
Efforts continue in Ethiopia, despite
1 mile west from Tiananmen Square. In the beginning, I didn't believe it's a real bullet. I told people, calm down, because it's a rubber bullet.
The basic meaning of what happened in Tiananmen Square may simply be people wanting a greater say in their own lives.
You think that a global government would be a positive thing for the world?
Maybe in the distant future, but for now, I think our needs are best met through more localized government.
Unified government, because our governments are so broken up that we can't get anything.
I think that people are really starting to realize that it's got to start with the individual.
These are times of sweeping global changes. As governments try to define the order of the new world, citizens sometimes find themselves working autonomously for their own version of order, believing their leaders to be locked into outmoded ways of thinking and acting.
Here's the story of a group of women who tried to help navigate the new world order away from a very old response to world crisis, war.
Radio contact from a United States Maritime Patrol aircraft to the Ibn Khaldun in the Arabian Sea a couple of weeks before the start of the Gulf War. The Ibn Khaldun was an Iraqi-bound freighter filled with women from around the world carrying food and medical supplies. Soon after these radio messages, the ship was taken over by the U.S. Navy. E. Fay Williams, an attorney and politician from Louisiana, was one of two Americans on board.
We announced to the world that we were going on a peace mission simply to bring milk, medicine, food, and messages of peace and of love to the people of Iraq so that they knew that there were people in the world who did not want to see all of them and their loved ones dead, and that we indeed wanted a negotiated settlement to the war.
Starting in Algeria, the ship sailed across the Mediterranean, stopping in Libya, down through the Suez Canal, across the Red Sea, and into the Arabian Sea. Food and medicine were donated during stops in several Arab countries.
And the women would go into their villages and collect milk and medicine so that these would be gifts. We were in no way breaking the sanctions at that point. We were simply trying to draw attention to prevent a war.
This welcoming celebration was recorded at the peace ship's stop in Sudan. It was recorded by the other American on board, Lori Betlock, a freelance journalist and activist.
As we arrived in Sudan again, we had this wonderful welcome. And as you know, the Sudanese people have been through so much themselves, and they're a very poor country, hardly able to feed their own. Yet, they gave. And it hurt to take it from them, but they wanted the Iraqi children to know that they too cared.
On the morning of December 26, 1990, 2 days before the ship was scheduled to arrive in Iraq, a gunboat pulled up alongside. Pretty soon, the Ibn Khaldun was surrounded by mostly U.S. military boats and helicopters.
Stop!
Young, brave American soldiers were dropping down on ropes and running with their guns drawn toward these unarmed women that they already knew were unarmed. We continued to be surrounded by 14 or 15 warships. We were totally surrounded with this big sign on all sides of our ship saying, Ship of Peace. We had been searched. They knew we had nothing more dangerous than sugar. And we were singing, We Shall Overcome. They were releasing the tear gas right in our faces, so we had a lot of eye injuries, and there was no place for us to go unless we wanted to jump overboard right in that confined area. They were kicking us with those heavy combat boots. They were firing across our heads to try to confuse us, and they were yelling obscenities at all of these women. They would grab women, some of them with little babies in their arms, yelling and screaming the F word, you know, that ends in K. This one Marine, I mean, it was his favorite word, everything that he said. So here I am, thinking, you're an American. You can talk to these guys. And all the women were looking to me to do just that because I was the American. I put my hands up and I tried to talk to him. He started yelling all kinds of obscenities to me, and he just started beating us all back into the ship. They were swinging their guns and firing the guns, still yelling the obscenities, and I kept saying, please tell me what you want. I'll tell the women what you want. We didn't know why they were there. And so they refused to tell us. They just kept beating us back into the ship. I said, please, I'm an American. Oh, my God, what did I say that for? But he said, you're no the F word American. As far as I'm concerned, you're the F word Iraqi. And if you don't get the F word out of my face, the next word I say is going to be a bullet through his head. By his, he had the gun at the captain's head, and he was standing there, the captain with his hands tied behind his back. And he was yelling all of this at me. And at that point, the same tall Marine saw that Lori, the American journalist, was standing there with her little tape player recording all of this. He let go of the captain. He ran over to her. He grabbed the recorder out of her hand. He took the back of his gun. He not only beat up the tape, he beat up the entire tape player, just ripped it all apart, went in the radio room, ripped all the tapes out of there, smashed up the radio so that we couldn't communicate before we ultimately went back to fix the radio after they were gone.
It should be said here that the Navy has denied women were roughed up or that personal equipment was damaged on the ship. In fact, at the time, the Navy told media that sailors were attacked by the ship's crew. Faye Williams says the Ibn Khaldun was held captive from December 26th to a few days before war broke out. The ship was escorted to Oman, where the women were told they had to abandon the food gifts.
Finally, we were free to go to some extent on January 13th. As we neared January 15th, the women were getting very, very nervous, but they were determined we were going to end this mission. We were going to go through with it. And so on January 14th, the evening of, we came into a port just south of Basra, where the early attack, much of the bombing was done the first night. The Iraqis were already braced for war. But they quickly opened the Basra airport, sent a plane down from Baghdad for us, took us back up to Baghdad, gave us something to eat, and then rushed us out of the country. And as I was changing planes in Paris on the way home, the bombs began falling on my wonderful friends that I had just spent the last 40 days with.
These women's efforts at citizen diplomacy obviously did not prevent war. But Faye Williams still thinks the mission was worthwhile. Women from all over the world came together during a time of global crisis and spoke out for what they felt was right. Part of Williams's mission since the war has been to tour this country, telling the story of the Ibn Khaldun.
Since I have come back from the Gulf War, I have spent my time talking with other people about
how we avoid being consumed and destroyed by our anger and by the bad things that happen in this world. And I think all of the things that happen to me simply make me more courageous and make me know that I need to stand up and to speak out.
First world riding high, second world standing by, third world under fire, funny how we all conspire. We don't know, cause we can't see how such a way could come to be. Riding on a spinning wheel, soon enough we'll be revealed. Whose world is this? Whose world is this? Whose world is this?
There are countless ways world citizens have been working for their own new world order. People-to-people contact played a large part in East and West devilifying one another. Activists from one part of the world sometimes offer solidarity to grassroots human rights and environmental movements around the globe by linking up or perhaps simply by writing letters to foreign governments, reminders to leaders that the world is watching, witnessing. And there are those like Russell Gasser who have made it a way of life to try to dissolve borders and share cultures.
There's a term that's used in Spanish a lot that doesn't translate to English quite the same, but it's internacionalista, which translates into the English internationalist, and it's an exact description of what I'm doing.
What Gasser does is live and work in a country other than his home country. On a bicycle trip through Central America, he happened across a small group of war-disabled Nicaraguans who were starting up the country's only wheelchair repair workshop. Gasser had skills that were useful, so he stuck around Managua for a few years to play a leading role in getting the cooperative going. He insists, though, that he didn't do it to help. In fact, he believes that the very notion of aiding other countries is cultural imperialism. The well-off helping the less well-off is a harmful paradigm, according to Gasser, that furthers our attitudes of separateness.
I don't see I'm going to Nicaragua to help. I'm in Nicaragua because I enjoy it there. I'm going to be very sorry to leave. I have some very good friends there. The social organization and social priorities of the people I live and work with are tremendous, very, very positive. The fact is that they don't always have enough to eat. Because the rich countries get more than their share and the poor countries get less than their share. Not because these people are lazy or indolent or whatever. These are hard-working, scrupulously honest people. It's really delightful where I live. I mean, I have such a good deal. The neighbors are all interested in this strange foreigner who lives amongst them. Because I live in the same style as them, I don't have a motor vehicle, I work just the same as everyone else, I get paid the same as everyone else in the workshop, I eat roughly the same food. And all my neighbors watch out for me, and when they're going and leaving their house empty, they would ask me to keep an eye on it. And it's that sort of interchange and that sort of community spirit, this sort of feeling that people really hark back to. Well, I live with it. I have the privilege and the chance of living like that today. And it really does beat living in considerable material luxury but not knowing your neighbors.
El Salvador, 1992. A year of hope for this war-torn nation. On the eve of the new year, El Salvador's U.S.-backed right-wing government sat down at the peace table with leaders of a ragtag guerrilla army, the FMLN. There at United Nations headquarters in New York, they signed an accord that promised land reform, demilitarization, and free elections. I was in El Salvador at the time with eight women from California and Washington State. Our delegation planned to meet with women's groups and offer support. We were carrying about $8,000 in donations and a dozen extra suitcases filled with educational and medical supplies, contraceptives, and miscellaneous items we thought might be useful. As a citizen diplomat, I wanted to show that despite the official policy of my government, I supported the popular groups working for peace and social justice. I also wanted to bring some of their stories back home. On New Year's Day, I celebrated the promise of peace with thousands of people in San Salvador's main square. El Salvador's peace accord is a victory for the people. In 12 years of war, 75,000 civilians were killed and nearly a quarter of the population left homeless and on the run. While many ended up in refugee camps in neighboring countries, a small number, like Maria Serrano, joined the armed resistance, the FMLN.
Maria Serrano, me llamo.
My name is Maria Serrano, and I am a revolutionary. I have great conviction and a clear idea of what I want and where I am going.
Maria was a campesina, a wife and mother when she met an American woman, an internationalist, who decided to make a film about her to educate Americans on the nature of the war and U.S. involvement.
Christiani is trying to do a job for democracy, and the left-wing...
The film, Maria's Story, profiles this ordinary woman who joined the FMLN after her own daughter was tortured and killed by the military. Today, Maria and other members of the FMLN have come down from the hills to take an active role in El Salvador's future. One of the first things she did was come to this country to meet face-to-face with North Americans.
Hemos logrado, con 12 años de guerra, revolucionar la Fuerza Armada títere criminal del régimen. Y este pueblo...
In one of her talks, Maria credits citizen activists and internationalists for their solidarity work and its role in bringing peace. Ordinary people, by the very act of sharing and speaking out, can further peace in many ways. The results may seem subtle, more intangible than big governments bargaining with each other, but when people touch each other, the effects reach our very cores. There's a saying in El Salvador, "We don't bury our martyrs, we imitate them." In the capital city, a women's group called Se Mujer described for us their work teaching popular education, women's rights, and non-traditional employment. Two large portraits dominated the small space where we sat. After the presentation, we asked the director, America Guirola, about the pictures on the wall. "That's my sister Norma," she told us, "a pioneer in the women's movement. And that's Tanya, my niece, a student at the university." Both were gunned down by the army on the same October day in 1989. We asked the women if we could share a moment of silence in their memory. As we stood together and held hands, their grief broke loose. First one of them and pretty soon all were crying. We cried with them and held each other. In their work to build a just society, these women had never taken the time to grieve. After a few minutes, America picked up her guitar and began to sing. About 3 hours by car from the capital lies the community of Nueva Esperanza, New Hope. 250 Salvadoran refugees returned from Nicaragua in the spring of 91 to build a repatriation settlement in the province of Usulután. In 8 months, they had cleared land, planted crops, built houses, established a school, and organized working committees covering everything from roads to human rights. We met with community leaders and made a proposal to the education director. To my delight, he accepted. I watched as he lifted the megaphone to call children out under the spreading tree. They arrived barefoot from all directions, carrying their desks with them, and smiled as their teacher introduced me and told them they'd have a sister school in the United States. I passed out paper and pens so this next generation could draw something for their North American pen pals. I'm sure it's through these fragile connections, child to child, community to community, and ultimately nation to nation, that our hope for global unity lies. Through simple acts, the personal becomes political, the political global, and we realize that we're all in this together.
Yes,
That essay was by Earth on the Air producer Suzanne Tedesco.
During the 19th century, a Polish teacher, L.L. Samenhoff, invented an international language. Esperanto was designed to bring cultures closer together, to help break down walls between nations. An example of an Esperanto word is servas, to serve. In the 1940s, an American pacifist named Bob Lutweiler chose Servas as the name for an international hospitality organization trying to bring the world a little closer together. Today, over 11,000 households in 100 countries open their doors to visitors from other nations. George Howland traveled throughout Italy with Servas in the spring of 1991.
Do you eat lentils? La Signora dipped a spoon into the soup pot. What a relief! She remembered from my letter that I didn't eat meat. It was my first day traveling with Servas. My Servas host, Lucia, lived with her aunt in a small town near Naples. I never did learn the aunt's name. I just called her Signora. My vegetarianism was just one of our many differences. I was 34. She was 80. I was 5'10". She was 5 feet. I wore my sandy-colored hair long. She wore her salt-and-pepper hair short. "Did you have a long trip?" La Signora asked. "Yes," I replied. "I came from Paris on the train. It took 27 hours. I flew into Paris with my girlfriend." "You left your fiancé alone in Paris?" She set the table as she talked. "You should have married her before separating for such a long time." We sat down to eat. After the lentil soup, she served mountains of fried potatoes and fish. Then she asked, "When is your wedding? You can come and stay here on your honeymoon." I shrugged. "I'm not sure I'm getting married. Jody thinks marriage is a raw deal for women." "What kind of a crazy girl is your fiancé? You should get married. That's what God Almighty intended." I stalled by wiping my lips. As a Servas traveler, was it incumbent on me to begin the dialogue about our differences? Before I could decide, she took an eggplant casserole out of the oven. She gave me a large serving and said, "You and your fiancé should stop all this silly traveling. If God wanted us to fly through the air, why don't we have wings? Get married and have some children. What religion are you?" "I was born Catholic," I replied, "but I don't practice any religion. To me, there's truth in all religions, and no single religion holds all the truth." She smiled, nodding her head enthusiastically. "Very good, you're Catholic. Would you like to go to Mass with me tomorrow morning? We go to Mass every morning here." Explaining my agnosticism would have been the Servas thing to do, but my mom would have been thrilled if I went to church with the nice lady. La Signora cleared the table briskly. "What religion is your fiancé?" "She's Jewish," I replied. This threw her off her stride. My chance to strike a blow for multiculturalism had arrived, but she didn't hesitate long. She served a green salad. Over the next 2 days, La Signora continued to give me good-natured drubbings and fabulous meals at every opportunity. In previous visits to small Italian towns, I'd always felt like an outsider and a stranger. Being a guest of La Signora allowed me to experience the great warmth of village life, woven from the strands of family, religion, and community. The community was the center of her existence. In contrast, American society is organized around the individual. Our culture's much-discussed alienation is the result. When I compared my life to La Signora's, suddenly the isolation inherent in American individualism became very real. Servas's founders believed that world peace depended on ordinary people learning such lessons from one another. I'd learned, but what did I have to teach? On the last evening of my visit, La Signora and I sat on the couch in the living room watching a large television. A firefighter was recounting his rescue of 17 people from a sinking oil barge. La Signora's face expanded with great animation. "Just think of it," she said. "That man, he saved 17 Christians." As soon as the phrase escaped her mouth, she seemed to want to suck it back inside. For many Italians of her generation, Christian is synonymous with human being. But she knew my girlfriend was not a Christian. La Signora paused and looked worried that she had offended me. I met her gaze and smiled. I knew she didn't need a lecture. we understood each other. So I had brought something after all. A little of the world's diversity accompanied me into her homogeneous community. My fretting had been foolish. The magic of Servas was entirely mutual.
George Howland writes a newspaper column for several Northwest publications.
Hey, younger, oh, younger, hey, young, the earth is our mother. We must take care of hey, younger.
Because environmental degradation knows no national borders, individuals who become aware of the environmental consequences of their actions are working as global citizens without ever leaving home. More and more, people are speaking out about how changing one's personal lifestyle can be a profoundly political act.
We feel we have to wake people up to think about saving the earth. We feel we should come together as citizens of this earth and not as citizens of separate countries.
And I'm reminded of what Margaret Mead said. Never doubt that a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens can change the world. Indeed, it's the only thing that ever has.
What brings you here today?
Well, I'm thinking of the next generation and what environment they're going to have to live in.
We've only got 10 years to save the world. Then people don't wake up to what's happening to the environment.
We've got to educate people and start getting people to think of themselves as part of a global environment.
And I think it's good that we should get, you know, the president to do things like that, but it really lies in our own hands and not telling others, but things that we can do ourselves.
And what do you do?
We look at what we buy and especially what we eat, and we, you know, do little things here and there, and we just kind of try to spread the message and try to do what we can. I mean, of course, we aren't close to perfect, but we try. Yeah.
What kind of world will our children receive? After all is said and done, what kind of creed have we come to believe? That they may never receive one.
That's the show. Thanks for tuning in.
Contributing producers included David Fisher, Chris Wade, Peter Young, and Jean-Paul Bardou.
Don't forget, this is your program, too. Find out about becoming a member of Earth on the Air and receive a copy of our submission guidelines.
Write us at Earth on the Air, P.O. Box 45883, Seattle, Washington, 98145.
That's Earth on the Air, P.O. Box 45883, Seattle, Washington, 98145.
Earth on the Air's submissions director is Susan Gleason. Our executive director is Craig McDonald. The show is produced and edited by Peter Maloff and Suzanne Tedesco, engineered by Scott Bergen.
We had help from Lowell Harvey, Ted Gates, KUOW, and the Dub Train, cassette duplicating services in Seattle.
Music was by Jim Page, as well as David Hines, Peter Young, and Randy.
Production facilities provided by Jack Straw Productions in Seattle and KSER in Linwood, Washington.
Partial funding was from the Town Creek Foundation, the Bergen Foundation, and the Seattle Arts Commission.
If you'd like a cassette copy of this program, call 1-800-800-3145. Mention that you'd like program number 20. For the Earth on the Air Radio Works, this is Janice Kane.
And I'm Peter Maloff.